This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson on WLRN. Thanks for listening. In September 1995, 9-year-old Jimmy Rice was on his way home from his school bus stop in Redland. He disappeared, and the community mobilized over the following 3 months, searching high and low for the little boy. In December, Juan Carlos Chavez was arrested and charged eventually with kidnapping, rape, and murder. Chavez was put to death this week for the crime. Miami Herald reporter Jay Weaver was a witness to the execution, along with the family of Jimmy Rice.
Throughout this whole process, you know, the witnesses, including Don Rice, the father of Jimmy Rice, there's always this look of pain etched on his face that seems permanent. But he didn't really show, you know, any emotion. And I think it was because it was so silent in there and everything was so controlling. It was almost as if you were in an MRI chamber and you had to just completely remain still.
Jimmy Rice's older brother, Ted, spoke after the execution Wednesday night.
Many people did not believe that Juan Carlos Chavez should be put to death for his horrible crime of raping and murdering my brother, Jimmy Rice. And I believe this comes from a place of weakness, not strength. It comes from not being able to face the atrociousness of some men's actions and punish them on a level commensurate with their crime. But we must be strong. We must do what it takes to send a clear message to other child predators that if they go after children, if they kill children, that they will die at the executioner's hands. Today will bring no closure for my family. As my father has stated, closure does not exist. But the justice served this day after a painful 19 years will end the chapter on this part of our life. And now we look forward to moving on.
Over the 19 years between the death of Jimmy Rice and the death of his killer this week by lethal injection, Jimmy Rice's mother and sister passed away. What are your memories of the Rice case here in South Florida? How were you affected as a child, as a parent, as an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent? Are Florida's sexual predator laws effective? Join the conversation at 800-743-WLRN, on the phone at 800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org. Tweet us using the handle @WLRN or our live chat ongoing right now at WLRN.org. Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald is along with us. Nando Vila from Fusion and Tia Mitchell from the Tampa Bay Times joins us via Tallahassee. Amy, what gripped this community and really the nation back in 1995 with the Jimmy Rice missing case?
Well, I think the case served as a bit of a turning point. When I talked to Don Rice for my story that ran last Sunday, he said, you got to remember back in those days, people were not that aware of sexual predators. Parents were not that aware of it. And to have this boy taken from almost right in front of his house in daylight, and killed, it really shook people. And I covered the trial in 1998, 3 weeks long in Orlando, and it was a very emotional time for the community.
It was so emotional that, in fact, they could not seat a jury in Dade County for the trial. It was moved. It was a change of venue.
Exactly. They tried to seat a jury in Miami-Dade, and person after person got up and said, you know, I think he's a monster. I can't sit on the jury. So they eventually did move it to Orlando, which for the Rice family was one more delay, one more difficult time for them as they waited again to seat another jury in Orlando.
Yeah, it was 3 years between the disappearance and the eventual trial and conviction, 16 years then until the execution this week of Juan Carlos Chavez. What's the legacy of the case, do you think, Amy?
Well, there are multiple, and that's one of the things that the Rice family was so adamant about, that they wanted Jimmy's death to stand for something. And so they formed a whole lot of things. They started a charitable organization. They started raising money to buy bloodhounds and give them to police stations or to police departments, mm-hmm. because they thought that there was a possibility that if they'd had one available to them when Jimmy disappeared, they could have at least gotten the direction that he had gone in when he was grabbed and put into Chavez's car. And he was held just less than a mile away from their house.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable about the proximity of all of this. Nando Vila from Fusion, you today are the same age that Jimmy Rice would be. You're from this community, grew up in Dade County. What are your memories of the case as a child and even as a teenager?
Yeah, I mean, I remember when, you know, talking about it in school, and it was kind of like one of those things that everyone was like really freaked out about. And preparing for the show, I was talking to a bunch of my friends that I grew up with. And they remember it very well as well, you know, as well. Mm-hmm. It was definitely one of those things that kind of sticks with you if you grew up here. So, yeah, I mean, it was quite a...
Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee. This is a case that continues to resonate even in preparation for the upcoming legislative session, doesn't it?
Absolutely. There are, and of course, there have been, unfortunately, heartbreaking cases since then. Most recently, the death of Cherish Periwinkle in Jacksonville. But it's leading to a lot of conversation and a lot of legislation that's been proposed to tighten up the state oversight and the confinement of sexual predators.
Yeah, trying to align some of the civil commitments with protections not only of communities but also, of course, with liberty protections of convicted sexual predators. We'll talk about that here a little bit more in a moment on the Florida Roundup. Marta joins us from Kendall on the program. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, and good afternoon. First of all, I'd like to send my heartfelt condolences to the family who I know has been dealing with this for quite some time. I'm an educator, and I'm listening to you during my lunchtime. Thank you for being here. I wanted to say one of the things that frustrates me, and I when I heard about this case, I was a teacher, and I didn't live far from where this occurred, and I was a teacher in Campbell Drive at Homestead, and we were all affected by it because several teachers had worked at the school where Jimmy Rice attended. Now, I was very disappointed in the length of time that it took to bring this man to justice. And listening to what the brother said just now on the radio, and I really, just as an educator working with children, my prime, what I do most is protect my students, and I just feel like it's so unfair that the family had to wait so long for justice. And how can they make this change then?
Marta from Kendall, and your definition of justice in this case was the execution of the convicted party, not the conviction.
I think it took too long, if you forgive me for, I don't want to seem, but I don't think, the length of time it took for that, 19 years. I when he attacked this child and did this poor and hideous, took this child and did this hideous act on him, that was done quickly with, I don't think there was any remorse. I would like to see legislation change. And, for people like me who work with children and protect children every day, and for those animals, excuse me for calling them that, on the streets, it shouldn't take this long for justice to be handed down to a person that has, that has done this.
Marta from Kendall, thank you for joining the conversation, and thank you for your service in the classroom for the students of South Florida. I want to talk about, Tia, how legislators in previous sessions have talked about trying to perhaps shorten the appeals process during death penalty cases. But, Amy, you had a lengthy interview with Don Rice when he spoke about this time, the almost two decades that have passed since his son's brutal kidnapping and murder.
Right. The years have been rough on him. His wife died of a heart attack, and he says it really was of a broken heart. And his daughter committed suicide, and although there may have been some other things going on with her, he believes that, Jimmy's memories were weighing heavily on her at the time. And he's had some surgeries. He has to walk with a cane now, and yet he was absolutely determined to see this to the end. During the execution, he had an empty chair next to him for his wife. Mm. But he would totally agree with the caller that it takes way, way too long.
Yeah, and Tia, we've seen previous Florida legislatures pass laws that have tried to, I guess death penalty supporters will say, make the appeals process more efficient. Death penalty opponents will say it makes it too fast. We haven't necessarily seen the results of that legislation yet, have we?
Right. Just last year in the 2013 session, the it's called the Timely Justice Act, and it was proposed and passed by the legislature. And what it's intended to do is not necessarily to speed up the appeals process, but because they say, they want defendants to still have all the rights to appeal their case as much as possible. But the argument is, once those appeals have all been filed, once every option has been exhausted, the argument is that there should not be further delays in moving forward with the death penalty. But again, it's very new. Some defendants, of course, are not happy with the law, so there could be challenges. It has not necessarily been, you know, used yet.
This is the 13th execution of Governor Scott's administration, the 83rd since Florida reinstated the death penalty back in 1976. And in fact, Nando, just this week after this execution, Governor Scott signed his 14th death warrant for Robert Laverne Henry for a 1987 double murder in Deerfield Beach. Is it your sense for, you know, younger voters, death penalty is kind of a settled political issue?
I think so. I mean, it's one of those issues that I don't see sort of really mobilizing a large coalition against it. I think that, you know, MARTA, the caller's sentiments are fairly common. I would say that we should be very, very careful when dealing with the death penalty. I mean, the United States is the only developed democracy that enforces capital punishment right. on its citizens. And there have been cases of wrongful executions. Mm-hmm. We have to be very, very careful. We have to be absolutely sure. The desire for revenge and justice is a very, very common one. But we do have to recognize that it's an extraordinary right that we're granting to the state, the ability to execute one of our citizens.
The ability to make life and death decisions, yes. In this case, in regards to those convicted of crimes. One result, of course, of the Jimmy Rice case has been the Jimmy Rice Act passed here in Florida in 1998. This law requires the state to review sex offenders before they're released from prison. And one of the act's allotments is to allow the state to keep offenders in treatment beyond their prison term, civil confinement. Professor Jill Levinson has treated sex offenders and studies them at Lynn University.
Many individuals with the disorder of pedophilia can learn strategies for managing their behavior, controlling their behavior, changing their thoughts, becoming more aware of the harm that is caused by sexual abuse.
And she points out that the sex offender recidivism rate is about 5% lower than the overall recidivism rate. But Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Rundle believes it's the detention of offenders, not the treatment, that keeps the community safe.
Generally, it's accepted in the world of criminology. Your sexual offenders are the least, if you like, curable, that they haven't really found a cure to these kinds of crimes.
This is the Florida Roundup. Join the conversation at 1-800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN, on Twitter, at WLRN is the handle, or our live chat right now at WLRN.org. I'm Tom Hudson, Amy Driscoll from the Miami Herald, Nando Vila from Fusion, and Tia Mitchell from the Tampa Bay Times along with you. Tia, what are the legal issues with some of the proposals to tighten up sexual predator laws in the upcoming legislative session?
I believe the legal issues are what they've always been, even when the Jimmy Rice Act was passed, which allowed the state to confine sexual predators even after they served their prison terms. There are a lot of, you know, restrictions and requirements on how it can be applied. And for example, Juan Carlos Chavez himself more than likely would not have been required to be detained under the Jimmy Rice Act because he did not have a prior criminal history.
Right.
And so what the state continues to have to do, even as it considers the current legislation, is you want to balance the civil liberties and rights, as you've mentioned, of all Florida citizens against safety and wanting to protect children from being victimized by known sexual offenders. And so that's a criminal justice and a civil rights concern. But the legislation that's moving forward this year, so far, just about everything has been approved. It's moving forward. There are several bills that, for the most part, strengthen the laws to be able to detain
sexual
predators.
Yeah, and dig into that a little bit more, Tia. There's, I think, a quartet of bills that have been introduced talking about the length of sentences, having sexual predators report more personal information before they're released from prison, so presumably authorities can track them better, and even involving the psychologists that are used to evaluate these predators, these convicted predators, before they're released from prison.
Exactly. There's a multidisciplinary team in place that when sexual offenders are being evaluated for civil confinement, they kind of all do their evaluations. And one of the bills would add a prosecutor, a victim's advocate, and a law enforcement official to the multidisciplinary team. So kind of putting advocates for the prosecution and the victim into the mix of deciding what should be done with some of these defenders. Of course, there's been a Sun Sentinel report that about the current law, which in many ways is the Jimmy Rice law, and how there have been sexual offenders that were released and were not held in civil confinement and they reoffended. And so a lot of this is trying to rein that in. But again, it's one of those things where it's very subjective.
It goes to, again, this wane of personal liberty and state ability to protect its citizens, which is a big argument, but it's a subtle one when we're talking about the safety and security of children against either convicted sexual predators or potential sexual predators.
Yeah, it's a common sort of tension, whether it's in anti-terrorism laws or just generally criminal justice laws. But in the specific case of sexual predators, again, the United States is the most punitive developed democracy in terms of sexual predators, and it casts the widest net, which many people think makes it harder for authorities to track the very, very dangerous ones. You know, if you're sort of monitoring a whole bunch of people, you know, I think there's something like 700,000 people on the sex offenders registry, many of whom are not dangerous. Some of them were, you know, teenagers who slept with a minor and during consensual sex, and
but yet still remain under the law for sexual predators, sexual offenders,
often for life, and they're treated equally.
That's the complaint against the Florida law, is it doesn't make the designations in. Boy, and it's a tough argument to make, the seriousness of a sexual crime involving a child.
Right. Yeah. And again, no politician wants to be branded or be open to the label of being soft on child molesters, right? But it's often what happens in these cases is that we make emotional decisions in legislation that aren't necessarily the most targeted or smart legislation we can make.
This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. That is Nando Vila from Fusion, Amy Driscoll from the Miami Herald, and Tia Mitchell from the Tampa Bay Times along with me. I am Tom Hudson. Join this conversation here on WLRN. Lynn joins us from Kendall. Lynn, go ahead.
Yes. As I said, my name is Lynn. I am the parent of a murdered child, and I certainly feel for the Rice family and all others in our situation. But I am opposed to the death penalty for the following reason. It is a very costly and expensive proposition, not only to keep the person incarcerated, but to keep the appeals which they are entitled to so that we don't make a mistake. I would prefer that the death penalty be eliminated and that they be permanently incarcerated, period, end of story, so that if DNA evidence comes around later, we haven't made the ultimate mistake. And they are truly punished. They never take a free breath as long as they live.
Well, Lynn, I'm so sorry to hear about your tragedy involving your son. If I may, has the killer been caught, convicted, incarcerated?
He was convicted. He is incarcerated. Now, he was convicted in California. We observed and were there for three trials, two mistrials, and then finally a third trial with a conviction. He was convicted for 20 years because that's the maximum sentence in California. They did not give a life sentence for his particular offense. But I promised myself and my daughter and my husband that I'll be in my 80s when he comes up for parole. And if he's there for parole, I will be asking them to deny his parole. I think he should be in jail for life.
And Lynn, do you feel that justice was served?
You know, it's a very hard question because as a mother, there's never justice. And that's why we as bereaved families can't make these decisions. It has to be an impassioned decision by a legislator. So there's never justice. My son never comes home. And it has to be left to others in this situation.
Well, Lynn from Kendall again, our full sympathies for you and your family for the tragedy that you had to endure. But Amy, you know, obviously a first person perspective on capital punishment, and one that perhaps isn't as vocal in this conversation or debate that we may be having, as let's face it, the pace of these death warrants has picked up in recent years here in Florida.
Right. I we do hear from these people sometimes, and it is an extraordinary position because it requires quite a bit of forgiveness, or at least an ability to make peace with the outcome. Mm-hmm. I think for Mr. Rice, it was a, as he would say, it was not closure.
And he was very persistent about that. That's a word that, let's face it, us in the media like to use as we move on to the next story. And it's a very kind of impersonal word, but he was very insistent in using it and saying, this is not closure. Don't call it closure. It will never be closed in this case.
Right. He's going to live with this forever, and he knows that. And so is his son.
Yeah.
And certainly the rest of the family. He, you know, for him, it was a conclusion that he wanted. He wanted to see the end of Juan Carlos Chavez's life, but he does not want Jimmy Rice forgotten.
Certainly not. Michael joins the conversation here on the Florida Roundup from Miami. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to make the comment that, you know, obviously all of us, when something like this happens, we feel horrible, and the desire for revenge is very natural, but there's a reason that we have, in theory, an impartial justice system, and that's so that we can lower the chances of making mistakes, whether it's imprisoning people or putting people to death. And
but are you satisfied that the appeals process has worked? Juan Carlos Chavez had an appeals process. The process ended on Wednesday night, just after 8 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, I'm against the death penalty, but in terms of am I satisfied that the process went well, I suppose so. I mean, I haven't followed it, during all these years, and I remember I was in third grade when it happened. I haven't followed it, and so I don't know exactly why he was appealing, but yes, I think that we have to be very careful about wishing that when we sentence someone to death that, you know, they get killed in 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
There's a reason, you know, that we have to kind of take a step back and think about it logically.
Michael, thank you for joining the conversation here from Miami. Let's go to Sean, who joins us here on the Florida Roundup from West Palm Beach. Sean, go ahead.
Hi, how are you doing this afternoon?
Good, your comments.
I'm a very strong proponent of the death penalty, but I don't see it as punishment or deterrent. I see it as sort of cleaning house. There are just certain individuals who are too dangerous to be part of society, and I don't think it's worth our resources to sustain them for a long and costly life within the penal system. At the same time, I'm leery of the death penalty, mainly because there have been far too many innocent people who have been subjected to it. It's one of those catch-22s. I really would like to see it streamlined, but it can't really be streamlined without it being 100% error-proof.
Sean, with West Palm Beach there. Amy, you know, when you spoke with Don Rice about the last 16 years during this judicial process that he's lived through, the 19 years, of course, since the kidnapping, rape, and murder of his 9-year-old son, Jimmy, did he give you a sense of his patience, his acceptance of the appeal system, or was it an impatient father in waiting?
Well, he was both, because he's a lawyer and a father, and so he understood the system, and I think that he and his wife Claudine, who was also a lawyer, mm-hmm. Knew all along that it was going to take many, many years to reach this point. But they also, as parents, were extraordinarily impatient and angry. And one of the things I asked him right away was, are you still as angry today as you were when I talked to you during the trial? And he said, yes, I am no less angry than I was before. And he recognizes that, you know, the deterrence level may not be something that goes into someone's mind. They may not be thinking about this but it's one of the things he brought up, is that he hopes that somebody, the next time somebody has a child, they will think twice and say, you know, I'm not going to kill this child.
That is Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald, Nando Vila from Fusion, Tia Mitchell from the Tampa Bay Times along with me. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Stay close. We've got a lot more to come, including race, firearms, and self-defense in the Sunshine State. Back on trial in Jacksonville. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. As we're live here Friday afternoon, a jury in Jacksonville is deliberating a first-degree murder charge against Michael Dunn. He's charged with the premeditated first-degree murder shooting of 17-year-old Jordan Davis. Davis was shot during an argument over loud music. Michael Dunn, the shooter, testified this week at his trial that he felt threatened because he had seen Davis draw a gun.
Now, in your mind, did you think he was just going to get out to yell at you some more?
No, this is the point where my death is imminent. He's coming to kill me. He's coming to beat me. I'm not real sure what his intentions are. Actually, he made it very clear what his intentions were.
But again, you only know what you're being told and what you see.
Yes, and not having any doubts at all between his threats and his actions. That is a gun in the window.
Michael Dunn taking the stand in his own defense at his first-degree murder trial this week in Jacksonville. Police did not find any weapon in the SUV where 17-year-old Jordan Davis was killed. So what role does self-defense play? Join our conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. That's WLRN. You can also use that as a call sign on Twitter and punch it into your web browser, WLRN.org. We're joined by Rayma Thompson of our sister station WJCT, who's at the courthouse in Jacksonville where the jury is still deliberating. Any questions here on Friday morning from the jury?
No questions to speak of yet. It's been surprisingly quiet compared to yesterday when we had three questions, bringing the total to four jury questions since deliberations began.
Anything that we can read into the questions that the jury has asked and the prosecution and defense have actually answered?
I think probably what was most telling was the last question, which regarding the date of the letter that Dunn had written from jail, where he recounted some of the events. That letter, it later came out from the judgment, that it was dated June 2013. Mm-hmm. And in that, actually during cross-examination, the prosecutor had brought this up. There's some inconsistencies with what Dunn recounted. I think, you know, you're going to find that the biggest issue that they're trying to find out is what was Michael Dunn's mindset at that time. Was at that time, did he actually believe that he was in imminent danger as he claimed to be? And that letter can probably provide a little bit of insight.
Which goes to the defense here that it was self-defense in this shooting of the 17-year-old and attempted murder of others. 10 shots fired in all in this case. And Rayma, you speak of jailhouse letters. Others have been made public. And boy, have shown here, Nando, that race is also a role here. It may not be, you know, necessarily in the record, in the testimony that the jury has listened to, but this is one of the letters that Michael Dunn wrote from jail that was released this week. Quote, "The jail is full of blacks, and they act like thugs. This may sound a bit radical, but if more people would arm themselves and kill these blank idiots when they're threatening you, eventually they may take the hint and change their behavior."
Yeah, I mean, and that's what one of the problems with Stand Your Ground is that if the killer feels an imminent threat, then he has the right to shoot. So if that person has any sort of racial bias or prejudice against a certain race, and they feel that that race is threatening to them, then it would cause them to be maybe a little bit more jittery, with a gun in their hand.
And does it provide a defense with an argument? But in this case, Rayma, stand your ground was not exerted as the defense theory, was it?
No, and that was actually something that Strolla addressed. It's been addressed in the past, but Strolla addressed that again yesterday when he took questions from the media right before the noon break. He brought up again how stand your ground was not an immunity that was sought by the defense in this case. That was a strategic and intentional by the defense just because of the controversy of that. And they actually were hoping not to have such a high-profile case when he first took on the case. He was the second attorney for Dunn. Mm-hmm. And with all the negative publicity that had already garnered, he said that they intentionally did not want to bring Stand Your Ground. So what they are arguing is justifiable use of force. In the case of Stand Your Ground, the defendant had the perception that they're in danger, and they have the option to fight or retreat. Estrella is arguing that in this situation, or rather Dunn is arguing that in this situation, there was no room for retreat, only to fight.
Raymond Thompson with WJCT is with us from the courthouse in Jacksonville, where the jury continues to deliberate the first-degree murder case against Michael Dunn, as well as, I believe, three attempted murder cases. In the jury instructions, Rayma, usually the judge will be very explicit in terms of what is required for a first-degree murder conviction, and it really is premeditated shooting. And that premeditation doesn't have to happen over a half an hour or 5 minutes or 5 seconds. It could be an instant, but the premeditation is whether or not the defendant pulled the trigger with the intent to kill.
Right. And that is an issue. Again, it's right now the jury kind of has to get into this inside the mind of Michael Dunn.
That's
what
right.
He was thinking at that time, which, you know, that's obviously a tricky thing to do. But if in his mind he did perceive a very real threat, you can't. It's going to be hard for to argue that this was premeditated and intentional, as in the case, what the state is arguing for first degree murder.
Rayma, give us a quick idea of what the jury schedule is like. Will it remain over the weekend? Do we know yet? Has the judge made a decision?
I have checked in with the clerks to find out what's going on, and I've been told that most likely it will continue through Saturday if they don't reach the verdict today. You know, the jury is sequestered. They want to get through this as quickly as possible. That's not that's not the official word from the judge at this point. That's still to be determined, but the word around the court is that it's very likely that if they don't reach a verdict today, it's going to continue.
Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times, let me ask you from Tallahassee, as we've had obviously the George Zimmerman, a much higher profile national case that did not exert stand your ground. Michael Dunn case, which has made headlines and being very closely watched really throughout Florida, at least not exerting stand your ground. Is this, as far as the legislature concerned, a subtle issue?
As far as the legislature is concerned, there is no appetite amongst the Republican-led legislature to alter the law. Of course, Democrats have complained, especially after the death of Trayvon Martin, that there needed to at least be changes to erase some of the gray area that law enforcement agencies themselves have long complained that the law creates in cases. And also, I think it depends. The verdict could affect the conversation. Again, it's an election year, and the Republicans control the legislature, and nobody wants to look soft on crime going into an election. However, I believe that if Mr. Dunn is acquitted, there could create an appetite for changes, perhaps even down the road. Mm.
Tia Mitchell with Tampa Bay Times, Rayma Thompson with WJCT Radio in Jacksonville, Nando Vila with Fusion, and I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN, and of course, yes, it is an election year. It was 52 years ago this month that President Kennedy announced the permanent trade embargo of Cuba, and this week, former Republican governor and current Democratic gubernatorial candidate Charlie Crist told Bill Maher on HBO it's time to end the embargo. This is from a CBS4 report.
I don't see a lot of politicians from Florida having the courage to stand up to that small Cuban community.
Well, I think they need to. I think it's the right thing. I mean, the embargo's been there, what, 50 years now?
Right.
I don't think it worked. It is obvious to me that we need to move forward, and I think get the embargo taken away.
That was Charlie Crist a week ago on Bill Maher, Real Time on HBO. Not surprisingly, Governor Rick Scott reaffirmed his support for the trade embargo against Cuba.
Cuba is not free or democratic. The embargo that's in place is part of standing up for the Cuban individuals, Cuban families' freedom.
Is it time for this trade embargo to end after more than a half century? Does this issue split your household? Is this a political issue a half century later? Let us know at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Send your email comments to the Florida Roundup at WLRNnews.org, on Twitter at WLRN, and of course our live blog right now at WLRN.org, hosted by our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow. Nando, let me ask you, do you think Crist's statement was planned? Is this something that he has been prepared to flip-flop on? Has he been waiting for the opportunity to insert his desire or at least opinion to end the trade embargo? Although, let's face it, the Florida governor really has no role to play with a national trade policy.
I would be surprised if he hadn't planned this. I mean, the embargo is one of the issues in Florida, right? It's like one of the, if you're running for office in Florida, that's one of the issues you have to have a sort of very clear strategy on. So if he went on national TV and just kind of said that off the cuff, I would be very, very, very surprised.
Well, we got more on this issue, the Cuban embargo, and a new poll finds that the majority of South Floridians support a significant change in relationships between America and Cuba. Let us know by joining that conversation again at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. That's all still to come here on the Florida Roundup. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening. Two out of three residents in South Florida would like the U.S. to normalize relations with Cuba. Two-thirds of all Floridians would like the United States to remove travel restrictions to Cuba. What do you think? Join this conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Nando Vila from Fusion, Tia Mitchell from the Tampa Bay Times, and joining us from the Miami Herald is the Deputy Editorial Page Editor, Juan Vasquez. Juan, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Nice to hear from you. Why do you think that we're hearing some of these differences in views, for instance, from elected Republican officials, for instance, Governor Scott saying maintain the trade embargo, and South Floridians in this most recent poll?
Hi. First of all, thank you for having me, and good afternoon. I think it's fairly clear that, you know, maintaining, supporting the trade embargo has always been the safe position in Florida politics. The people who support the trade embargo feel very strongly about this, whereas people who might have a different opinion, this issue is not a game changer for them. It's not the one that makes them decide whether to vote for one candidate or another in most cases. I think the bottom line on this poll, we've known for years that the policy was evolving. Mm-hmm. I think what the numbers show now is that it has evolved to the point that a significant majority supports some kind of change, whether you call it normalization or a thaw. They want to see some change.
Juan, let me ask you, do you read this poll in a way that informs you that the safe position for a politician is no longer status quo on the relations between Cuba and the United States?
No, I don't read it that way, because I still think the intensity factor remains very strong. People who are supporters, as I said earlier, are those who are likely to make this the issue on which they will decide their vote. Just as it is, it's one of those issues like abortion or, say, the death penalty that is uppermost in the minds of a significant sector of the voters.
Nando Vila, how has this issue evolved as you've come to age? You grew up here in South Florida in the 80s and 90s. Not that you speak for your entire generation, but just, there is, some generational issues that that we're beginning to see. And as Juan mentions, as the populate idea about this relationship really has been evolving.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one significant window into that was the famous handshake, Obama and Raul Castro at the Nelson Mandela funeral.
Right, the 10-second handshake in South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up, if that would have happened, it would have been, you know, nuclear war here in Miami. And it kind of just came and went with minor protests from people here. It didn't cause that big of a stir. I think people are starting to realize that, you know, the policy itself has just failed on its merits. I mean, you know, we've been at it for 50 years and nothing has happened. It's just...
Meaning that regime change hasn't happened.
Regime change hasn't happened. I think people are realizing as well that, you know, the diplomatic approachment, similar to what Nixon did with China or what we're doing now with Iran, is the safest way to achieve the stated interest and policy goals of the United States. It's sort of isolating, and trade embargoes like this have very, very little effect.
Fernando joins our conversation. He's a member of the Public Insight Network here on WLRN. Fernando, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I'm one of those Cuban Americans that have evolved in their thinking over the last 54 years. 54 years is the time I've been in this country, and for many, many years, I was a strong advocate and supporter of very strong sanctions against the Castro tyranny. But at the end of the day, I look back and I look at the state of the Cuban people, the millions of hapless, suffering Cuban people, and I ask myself, how can we make a difference? How can we rationally and practically move this needle forward?
And how do you answer that question, Fernando?
And the question is, I think it is time to end this embargo. And quite frankly, I was inspired a couple of years ago by the Pope, John Paul, when he visited Cuba, and he looked at the Cuban people slowly, and he told them, do not be afraid. Let's open Cuba to the world and the world to Cuba.
Fernando from our Public Insight Network joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Ken also is with us on the program from Miami. Ken, go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me on. I'm an American history or a history teacher here in Miami-Dade County, and I'm really kind of shocked at Charlie Crist's comments. But on the other hand, I understand the other side. Again, I'm also a teacher, but I'm also a member of a Cuban-American household. So,
what shocked you about the former governor's comments?
Well,
why?
What shocked me was the pointed way he said that we need to end the embargo, but I really didn't hear about any solid alternatives. I think with that one that you said two-thirds support the ending of the embargo, I think there would be more support if that other third, which includes me, heard the alternatives. In other words, you know, you cannot turn your back on history. The regime in Cuba has a history of murdering people. That's well known, especially if you go back into Cuban history, 1950s, 1960s. I'm not one of those historians that just relies on past history. You also have to look to the future. I don't think we can turn our back on history. We have to look to the future, but what are the alternatives to dealing with these type of people?
Ken from Miami, thank you for joining our conversation here on the Florida Roundup, discussing the engagement between the United States and Cuba. How's it been evolving, and from a political standpoint as well as from a public polling standpoint? Juan Vasquez, deputy editorial editor at the Miami Herald. Ken makes an interesting point. Okay, so we normalize relations or begin to continue to evolve these relations to what? What is what's the status or what's the parameters of that evolution? What does it go to?
Well, supporters of the embargo would say, look, the point here is not that the embargo hasn't changed the nature of the Cuban government. The point is that the nature of the Cuban government remains as despotic as it has ever been. And the point of the embargo to begin with was to use it as a weapon against an adversary. And as we just saw today, there's a story in the Herald about how Cuba has become part of a global supply chain for weapons to North Korea in violation of UN sanctions. Again, supporters of the embargo would say this shows that the government has not changed, regardless of what the European Union or any third world country does.
Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee. This is kind of back on our radar, not that it ever left in South Florida, but back on the radar because of the former governor's comments, Governor Crist talking about timing to end the embargo and really paraphrasing, stand up to what Bill Maher called a small community of Cuban Americans in South Florida. How does this kind of play out as the governor's race begins to heat up, especially on the fundraising side?
I think this is such a classic kind of case study in politics, especially in Florida. Charlie Crist is the consummate politician. He announced this policy change on, you know, Bill Maher's show, who's, mm-hmm. you know, pretty liberal guy with a pretty liberal audience.
And shall we say it's a premium cable channel as well. This isn't an over-the-air local broadcast.
Or a regular cable channel.
Or a regular cable channel as
exactly.
represented by
Although,
Fusion.
Although his press shop, as soon as he made the announcement, made sure that the Florida Press Corps knew about it.
Yeah.
So it's very strategic. And I think it's basically, it's you know, it's like politics, game of chess. So on one side, Charlie Crist is taking a populist, you know, standpoint. The polls show that a majority of Floridians are kind of with him on wanting to normalize Cuban relations. At the same time, it requires Rick Scott to, you know, kind of take a continue taking a standpoint mm-hmm. that caters to a conservative base, if you will, but doesn't have necessarily the more, you know, general widespread appeal. So it's definitely kind of just part of the chess of politics. At the end of the day, I don't think most voters have the Cuban embargo at the top of their list when they go to the polls. Save maybe the South Florida, where it's a lot more important because that's where the Cuban population is, you know, is kind of centralized. But otherwise, it's not the most important issue of the day, but they want to make it an issue because it kind of plays to the politics of the race.
And it can certainly motivate some of that base as well. Jane joins our conversation here on the Florida Roundup from West Palm Beach. Jane, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm a Florida resident, and I do believe it's just time to normalize relationships. Florida, of course, can't change the national policy, but I'm glad the conversation has started, and hopefully between now and the elections in November, this topic will be discussed by Florida politicians, and we normalize relationships. We can't punish Cuba any further than they have already punished themselves.
Jane, you bring up an interesting point, and Juan, I'd like you to talk to this. We know that, obviously, the State House in Tallahassee does not have a role to play in international trade relations, at least not publicly. But, you know, if there is going to be a continued push to evolve the relationship in many different ways, travel restrictions or trade between the U.S. and Cuba isn't going to emanate from South Florida?
Well, I think South Florida is going to make a difference because that's where the votes are. It has always been considered the place where, you know, that could swing an election, and certainly policy toward Cuba could swing an election. But I think that there's a point that's been overlooked that's worth emphasizing and not overlooking. When respondents to this survey were told of Cuba's, quote, dismal human rights record, 49% were opposed to normalization or engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So there are variations within the poll and conditions that are worth keeping in mind.
Yeah, as a good journalist, Juan and Nando, you know it depends upon how you ask that poll question sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, if we ask people the same question about, you know, China's human rights record or Saudi Arabia's human rights record or our own human rights record, you know, then it would probably change their opinions on a lot of things. The fact is we deal with several governments who have shoddy human rights records, including our own. It's not surprising to me that two-thirds of Floridians want to end the embargo. I mean, it makes perfect sense in the sense that the people who stand to benefit the most from normalization with Cuba are Floridians.
Are South Floridians,
especially. And the Cuban people, for that matter. But Floridians, and specifically Miami-based South Floridians, are the ones who stand to benefit the most from normalization of trade relations with Cuba.
From a U.S. perspective, absolutely. We have to leave it there. My thanks to our guests throughout this hour. That's Nando Vila from Fusion. We've got Juan Vasquez from the Miami Herald, the deputy editorial editor, along with us. Thank you, Juan, for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Tia Mitchell from Tallahassee with the Tampa Bay Times. And my thanks also to Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald and Rayma Thompson with WJCC. CT. Thanks, of course, to all of the callers, all of the tweets, all of the web loggers, and all of the emailers as well. This is the Florida Roundup. We'll be back on the air again at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning and online at WLRN.org. The program is produced by Elaine Chin and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Executive producer and technical supervisor, I might add today, is the great Peter J. Merch. Thank you, Peter. We've got South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell next. Be sure to stay tuned for that. And Monday morning at 9 a.m. here on the Sunshine Economy on WLRN, it is The Color of Money, doing business while black in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a wonderful weekend. Happy Valentine's Day, and thanks for listening.